You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to the Ready Room, show number 34, Borg School Dropouts. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including LeVar Burton receiving the Elliot Pearson Award, Patrick Stewart's appearance on BBC's Hard Talk, Scott Bakula signing on to Star Trek Las Vegas 2012, Star Trek's top tear-jerking moments, plus a good helping of movie news and rumors. Then, in the feature, we're joined by Michael Fisher as we discuss the Enterprise episode Regeneration and the Borg in general. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How are you this week?
Oh, Chris, I'm doing fantastically. I'm coming off of working 7 days in a row, and I'm looking forward to working another 7 days in a row. So it's fantastic to take a little bit of time out of the office to come into the Ready Room.
So you're saving up those vacation days for a trip to Risa at some point, or maybe if you meet a smashing young lady on the Baku homeworld, right?
Exactly. You know, those Dabo girls don't come cheap.
That's what I hear. All right. Well, you know, we had a little excitement over here the other day. We had the strongest earthquake I felt here at my house since going back to the aftermath of the March winds. And yeah. And it happened. We had two of them in about a 3 minute span, 5.5, and then about, I don't know, 20 minutes later, we had a third one. And
oh, wow.
The epicenter was Mount Fuji, which, as you know, is not very far from me mm-hmm. as the crow flies, and I can actually look out the window and see Mount Fuji. And so I started picturing now what it would be like if Mount Fuji starts erupting at some point.
I was reading about it, and it's like, you know, there's going to be ash like all over Tokyo, like centimeters of it, if Fuji blows.
Yeah. It could be. I mean, like I said, it's really not geographically not that far. You know, it takes a little while to drive out there from here because of the winding roads you have to take. But, you know, if I could strap on a jetpack like Spock in Star Trek V and just fly straight over there, it's really not very far.
So, I mean, you're not talking about like a Pompeii situation, right? Where you're going to get covered in lava.
I don't know. It's not going to be like that, but... I'm not expecting it to erupt or anything like that. I just started picturing, you know, it's like I was thinking about like images in All Good Things.
Right.
Where Q takes Picard back to Earth and the volcanoes are erupting.
Right.
I was kind of having that picture. And, you know, it was no damage. You know, it's the kind of earthquake that we typically don't pay attention to in the past. But after the March 11th quake, suddenly now, when it's that strong,
exactly.
Like kind of.
Well, yeah, because I mean, leading up to March 11th, there were a bunch of earthquakes, and you started to get this sense, especially up in Tohoku, that there's something going on. Like, we don't know when, but there's going to be something happening pretty soon. So,
absolutely.
Hopefully you guys will stay safe down there.
So, what's been happening over there? Any exciting? You haven't had any volcanoes erupt, and
I
know that you have your power back on now. Argyle finally put down the bottle and got to work.
He did. It's actually the EXO from on the Pegasus, that engineer, he went down to my basement and started, you know, pounding with the hammer till it, you know, came back. Fortunately, we lost him, but he did some great work. And yes, I have power again. It was out for maybe 4 or 5 days, but I had it back in time for last week's show. And no, this week has just been rainy and cold. You know, it's typical Seattle spring at this point. Nothing too exciting going on here, really.
All right. Well, why don't we jump into a few things? And one thing I want to do before we get into news, Greg, is just to give a thank you to someone who left us a review on iTunes that was not for the Ready Room. And I think it's actually the first time that we've gotten a review for some of our other shows. Everyone knows the Ready Room. I don't know how many people actually listen to MatterStream or listen to the Captain's Log, which are the audio versions of our features. But we got a 5-star review from the Gorn Hunter for Captain's Log. And he just said that it's an excellent and insightful podcast and recommended for any Star Trek fan. So we really appreciate that. And I would like to invite everybody to go and check out the latest episode of Captain's Log, because friend of the show, Michael Fisher, who's writing the technology column now, has done an audio version of his communicators article. And it's fantastic. The narration of this piece by Michael really brings to life the humor in that article. So definitely go check that out. And you can find it. Go to our site, trek.fm/CL. That'll get you to the Captain's Log main page, and there are links on there to iTunes.
And if Gorn Hunter could please write in and clarify for me, are you someone who hunts Gorn, or are you a Gorn who is a hunter?
Yes, or are you someone who has a fetish for Gorn and you hang out in bars looking for Gorn?
Is that like a cougar for Gorn?
Yeah, yeah.
Cougar, is that a word that they know in Japan yet?
Ah, good question. I'm not quite sure about that.
Well, we'll have to talk about cougars in the other side of the room.
Okay, we'll do that. Coming eventually to you as a separate podcast. The Ready Room, the other side of the room. All right, Greg. Well, let's move on to one more thing here before we get into full Star Trek news. I'm sure you've been following the drive over the past few days to get five-year mission into the Rolling Stone Volkswagen tailgate party before the Super Bowl. And the voting closed about an hour before we started recording the show here, Greg. And I'm sad to say that they just barely missed the cut in very painful fashion.
It was crazy. I mean, four votes, right?
And four votes. Yeah.
And considering the drop from fourth place to fifth place was like several hundred votes.
Oh, yeah.
To then be out of it by four votes. I mean, they were leading early on. They were in the top three for most of it. Several high-profile tweets. A lot of people were getting behind five-year mission, at least to get them in the top three, get them to go to the Super Bowl party, to be in the consideration for playing at the Super Bowl. So close. I really was in shock right before the show when I loaded up the page just to, you know, verify, make sure they did make it in. And somehow it didn't happen.
Yeah, boy, it was close. I want to say I've been keeping an eye on it. At one point, I think it may have been last night, actually, before I went to bed, they needed about 40 votes or something to get back in. And I put out some tweets, and I got up this morning, and I had a message from Chris, and he said to, can you do one more promotion? We're coming down to the wire, you know, and I realized, oh, wait, yeah, it is only 1 hour left. And I looked, and they needed 18 votes.
Oh, man.
And I put out, word everywhere about it, and everyone went and voted again, and they got close, and it looked like they were going to pull ahead, and then at the last second, just fell short by four. But, you know, it's heartbreaking, but if you think about it, too, all of those bands, and, you know, in Indiana, that area there, you know, the University of Indiana is in Bloomington, and, you know, that whole area, there's lots of great bands around there, and the fact that a Star Trek band was able to hold down the number two or three spot for almost the entire voting process to go play at the Rolling Stone tailgate party before the Super Bowl was just amazing.
Yeah.
And I think it's a tribute both to the guys in the band and to all the fans as well, and how much everyone supports Star Trek.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the fact that everyone mobilized and got together, it really is a tribute to the community, and it really shows that people are out there. They care, they're paying attention. Five-year mission isn't a fluke. There's obviously a big backing behind them. And yeah, it is fantastic. And, you know, next year, hopefully they'll do the same promotion, and we'll have even more clout at that point and bring some more people on and actually make it happen next time. Although, I think it's this weekend that they're opening for William Shatner at some convention.
I think so. They were traveling to New Orleans, I think. And they tweeted that we have entered Alabama. And
right. So, five-year mission, they are going places fast.
At warp speed.
This one goes to warp 10.
But thanks again, everyone who mobilized and voted. Everyone appreciates it very much. All right, Greg, what else do we have up in news today?
What else we have in news? The next one is one of our favorite topics here on the Ready Room. LeVar Burton, who is, of course, well known for his role as that guy from Reading Rainbow.
Yes, that guy. The one without the visor.
Yes. Do you ever think that he and the guy who plays Cyclops in the X-Men films get together for drinks sometimes and just talk about what it's like to have a hairband over your eyes?
Probably. I think there's a support group for that.
Hairband support group.
Yeah. Well, he's going to be receiving this. It's the Elliot Pearson Award. And of course, the Elliot Pearson Award, I'm sure everyone knows, it's a very prestigious award that is handed out for those who have worn headbands across their faces for a minimum of 10 years. And no, seriously, the Elliot Pearson Award is handed out by Tufts University, and it's designed to honor those who are committed to excellence in children's media. And certainly, LeVar Burton has proven his dedication to educating children now for 26 years as the producer and host of Reading Rainbow.
Yeah. I think every child has that moment of realization when they're watching one show with the other and they realize, wait, that's the same guy. I've talked with a lot of other people who grew up as I did in the 90s who watched Reading Rainbow, watched TNG, and loved both and didn't realize for the longest time that it was actually the same guy. But I can't imagine my childhood without either of those things. You know, I always, right. I want it to be Geordi, and I want it to be the guy in Reading Rainbow. It's a weird thing. I didn't want to be Riker. I didn't want to be Picard. I always wanted to be Geordi down there in engineering doing barrel rolls.
Do a barrel roll. The barrel roll.
That's what I wanted to do.
Yeah, I'm just picturing Picard in the middle of a battle calling down to engineering, "Hey, guy from Reading Rainbow, we need warp power in 2 minutes or we're toast."
Right.
"We need warp power now or I'm going to have to set the auto-destruct sequence."
Exactly. But no, it's great to see, I almost called him Geordi. It's great to see LeVar getting the sort of recognition that I really think he deserves. Everyone knows and loves Reading Rainbow, but people bring up Sesame Street. People bring up Blue's Clues. You know, these are the kids' shows. Reading Rainbow, huge part of my childhood, isn't brought up that often, isn't remembered, I think, as well as it should be for really, really encouraging literacy and reading. You know, the people that I know today who are the intelligent people, the smart people who actually read, they didn't love reading because of school or because of their parents. They loved it because they went out and read, and a lot of them were encouraged, like me, by a show like Reading Rainbow. It was like showing you, look at books. Books are awesome. Don't you want to read books? Because they take you on an adventure. And that's, you know, I talk to people who don't read, and they're like, well, books are boring. Books are dumb. Books are school. You know, LeVar Burton is the one who promoted this idea of books take you places. And that's, you know, that's how you end up with a utopian society like in Star Trek, and not a dystopian society like in, say, Idiocracy.
Yeah. It seems like Reading Rainbow has just been around forever. It seems like more than 26 years, actually, for me. But it's amazing, the commitment. So it's great to see him getting this award. And it's going to be handed out on February 3rd at 10 a.m. at Tufts University Medford Somerville campus. And it's actually open to the public. So, you know, if you happen to be in that area and you want to go see LeVar Burton receive this award, you can do that. And it's free.
Very good. I mean, it kind of, you know, ruins the suspense a little bit, though, to pre-announce this. You know, I expect, you know, Brad Pitt, George Clooney, LeVar Burton, all up for this award.
And the nominees are... I just seen that, everyone. You're in this music center at Tufts University with the ceremony. And the nominees for the Elliot Pearson Award are George Clooney. Yeah. And then someone has trouble opening the envelope. And
right.
Yeah. It'd be very suspenseful.
Someone has trouble pronouncing LeVar Burton. Who was it that couldn't pronounce Jean? Now I can't even do it. Jean Giraud. The guy from The Artist. It was a very Stuart Baird moment at the Golden Globes when he couldn't pronounce any sort of and he just passes the envelope to
yeah, yeah. Lady. I think I saw that.
I forget actually, even who it was at this point, and I can't.
He didn't even want to try. Yeah, that's right. Anyway. Yeah, I thought you were going to say, who is it that can't pronounce Brian Finifter?
It's a difficult name. I can spell it. That doesn't mean I can say it.
All right. Okay. Well, moving on. We have a little bit of news here about Patrick Stewart. He appeared last week on a show called Hard Talk, which I'm not sure if people in America know this show or not. Does it come on BBC America, or do you have BBC News on the cable systems over there?
I think it does appear on BBC America. I don't get cable here, so I don't know. I don't I don't watch TV, but I do believe I heard people talk about this. But I think it might even be a show you can get in podcast form. I think I've seen it on the iTunes.
Oh, it's possible
over here.
Maybe.
But this is not an episode I've seen, but everyone's talking about it. I think you did manage to record it and watch it.
I did record it. Yes, and it's funny this. Show is it comes on at lunchtime here for us, and it is my wife and I have a joke about this show because we try to eat lunch before Hard Talk starts. It's like a race. Like we have to be finished with lunch by 12:30 because that's when Hard Talk comes on.
I see.
So we're watching the regular news on BBC, and then I have to finish before them because it is one of the most boring shows I have ever seen. All the excitement went into the production of the opening sequence graphics, which are very exciting. And so when the host comes on, it's such a letdown. But occasionally they do have interesting guests like Patrick Stewart. I think they've had Mikio Kaku, the physicist, on before. A few people like that for some very interesting conversations. And so this was a good one to see here. And, you know, they're talking about how Patrick Stewart took the job of Captain Picard and how he expected the show to fail.
Right. And it wasn't an awful lot of new things. It was a lot of stuff that William Shatner actually got out of him in the Captain's documentary.
Right.
But the host on Hard Talk seemed awfully concerned with the idea that Patrick Stewart had sold out by going to Hollywood.
Yeah. That's kind of the maybe new angle here a little bit.
Right.
Because like you said, most of this stuff is stuff that we've already known before. I think the fact that it's on BBC News Hard Talk was kind of a more high-profile general audience, you know, presentation of the information that a lot of us, you know, already know from things like The Captains.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot more people in general saw that episode of Hard Talk than saw The Captains, just based on it's a high-profile news show watched around the world. So it is interesting to see, you know, Patrick Stewart being still talked about it at this point. You know, I don't even think, I mean, it's not like he was promoting a movie or something. It was just, you know, let's get with Patrick Stewart and see. I guess he might be sort of promoting the next-gen Blu-ray disc that's coming out next week. But anyway, it's still interesting to see that this was an interview done. And, well, what do you think? I mean, did Patrick Stewart sell out by, you know, leaving the world of Shakespearean acting? You know, every time I load up Netflix, it has the also like, you know, Next Generation, or you might also like, and it has that production of Hamlet that Patrick Stewart did. And I'm not sure if just because I like Next Gen, I'm going to like anything else Patrick Stewart does, especially a production of Hamlet. But anyway, what is your opinion on him selling out?
I don't know. I have never thought, oh, I think Patrick Stewart sold out by going to Star Trek. I've never had that thought before. It does not surprise me that the particular host of Hard Talk would try to play that angle. But I've never thought that. You know, if anything, I think that his portrayal of Captain Picard and the way that the Next Generation became so hugely popular, I think probably the most widely accepted of all the Star Trek series amongst the general public, you know, made the idea of being intelligent and the idea of caring about literature and the arts and so forth stronger amongst the general public than maybe it would have been. You know, you often see that, especially in American culture, in entertainment, this kind of feeling like the arts are something that, you know, only bookworms read, and only nerds, you know, or not nerds, not the right, like high society stuck up people like Shakespeare or things like that, you know, whereas, you know, the whole base, this literature contains the whole basis and foundation of our civilization in it. And it's something that, you know, should not be forgotten. And I think that Star Trek, especially Captain Picard, The Next Generation, Patrick Stewart, you know, did a lot to drive home that message.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, definitely.
In a way that was kind of couch it in science fiction for people.
Yeah. I mean,
so,
before,
no, I don't think he sold out.
Yeah, I mean, before Patrick Stewart played, you know, Captain Picard, you know, young British boys thought that all they could do with their life was be a Shakespearean actor. And afterwards, they realized there's so many opportunities for me, you know? If I go out there and really make an effort, I can captain a starship. You know, I can control the sky. And I think that's really fantastic. That's really, because as we know, British men have been one of the most, you know, put down parts of our society. And to see them realizing their opportunities is really, I think, what makes Patrick Stewart's, you know, his arc as an actor, it makes it really important. I mean, they should be giving him an award. I mean, give that man an award.
And they also found out, not only can I captain a starship, but I can still go to the holodeck and I can still do my Shakespeare plays.
Exactly.
Right? That's right. Yeah. So I understand anyway that this episode, like you said, it may be available as a podcast. I actually haven't looked to see if it's there, because I already have some things that I can listen to help myself fall asleep at night. I don't need hard talk in podcast format, but this particular episode, I would recommend you going and grabbing. I believe it's available, segments anyway, on the BBC website. We'll put some links, whatever we find, in the show notes, and you can go check it out.
Great, great. All right, so what else do we have? I believe we have one more captain that we need to talk about, and that would be Scott Bakula, which, as you talk talk about Next Gen being the most accepted Star Trek series, I think Enterprise, we talked about this before, but the animated series is the most ignored series, but Enterprise is the most actively unaccepted Star Trek series. But it was built around this guy, Scott Bakula. They said, you know, that's a captain. Let's see what sort of show we can build around him. And I think he's a great one. And he's going to be joining a bunch of the other captains at the Las Vegas convention, which I believe is this fall.
Would be in August, yeah.
There we go.
Scott Bakula has joined the gang. What do you want to call them? A gaggle of captains, or what have you, at Star Trek Las Vegas for this year. And he'll be joining William Shatner and Kate Mulgrew and Avery Brooks. And I believe Patrick Stewart has also committed to Las Vegas, hasn't he? Or not I yet. He's doing Nashville, I think.
Right. I'm sure he'll probably be announced for it.
I'm sure he will. I mean, it's the 25th anniversary of The Next Generation, so they're going to have have everybody. Really. So,
and Kate Mulgrew will actually be cooking for everyone. I don't know if you saw that picture of Kate Mulgrew.
Is she going to cook some?
Did she tweet it or something? But she had this, her kitchen was like filled with stuff, like she pulled everything out of all of her pantries for whatever meal she was cooking. It looked delicious.
Oh, really?
Who knew?
I didn't see that photo. I thought you were going to suggest that she's going to cook some pecan pie to try to butter everybody up and see if anyone has some warp technology that could help her get home faster.
I genuinely never tried that tactic. That's not a bad one.
Yeah, actually she did. She did that in Prime Factors.
Apparently I need to watch Prime Factors again. Pecan pie,
yes,
really?
You do. Yeah.
All right.
But yeah, so Bakula is going to be there. Lots of other people. I do expect that the entire Next Generation cast is going to be there. I think they've got most of them already, don't they? They've got Frakes and Spiner, Marina. Michael Dorn's going to be there. John DeLancey, Colmeny.
Laverne.
Burton. Gates is going to be there. It's like, yeah, Laverne's going to be there. most everybody, I'm sure everyone will be there by the end. So that's going to be August 9th through 12th. And you can go over to the Creation website and get all the details. And I believe already pre-order some of the packages as well.
Yeah, very excited about that. I mean, I'd really love to go. I don't know. It might still be outside of my budget. I'm still having to work that out. But it looks like a fantastic thing. And hopefully we'll at least have a friend of the show there who can send us in a convention report or even do a, you know, live call in and be on the show from the convention and talk with us about it.
Oh, definitely. We'll find someone who's going to be there for sure. I was planning to go. I'm not sure at the moment if I'm going to be able to make it or not because of finances and so forth. As well. It's a pretty long trip from Tokyo, but at any rate, we'll find some roving reporter who can go around and ask very obvious questions to guests and see what...
Right. I have a lot of very obvious questions to ask Ron Moore, so it's probably best to keep me away from him as long as possible.
The only thing is that, although he is going to be there as well, mm-hmm. all of your questions are going to be about Battlestar Galactica.
Exactly. Right? No, actually, I talked with you about this. I want to have Ronald Moore on the show. I want to talk about the original filmed ending of Generations. I want to spend an hour talking about how much I love the original ending and why they didn't go with it. And I don't want to talk about anything else. And I think he's going to be really excited to join us and talk about that. I think that's going to be the highlight of his career is, you know, 20 years later discussing Star Trek Generations.
Yeah. For sure. You know, I think we talked about this before, right? And every time he tries to say, oh, well, you know, that was great, but I'm working on this new show, and you're going to say, right. That sounds interesting. It really reminds me of the original ending of Generations. Why don't we talk about that a little bit more?
Right, exactly. I don't.
We're going to get a reputation.
I think so. I don't think we talked about this on the show, so it's probably good to get it out there on the actual Ready Room anyway. Ronald Moore, right. If you're out there, you know. I will send you a case of absinthe if you will join us on the show.
All right, maybe this will come true. All right, Greg, so let's move on to the next thing here. Before we get into movie news, we have one more thing to talk about. Jordan Hoffman writes a column on StarTrek.com called One Trek Mind, and he put out a new one here this past week called the Top Tier Jerking Trek Moments. And he has a top 10 list of the most touching moments, I guess I would say, in right. Star Trek history. And what did you think about these?
Well, I especially like number one, the release of Star Trek V.
Yes, right. I was just thinking about that when I was plugging this story into the show page here.
But it's a good list. I mean, I don't know if I've ever gone on record on the show. I think I probably have. I don't get moved emotionally much by Star Trek. It mostly touches me, you know, intellectually. The only bit that really does it for me is the very beginning of Star Trek 09 and that whole birth of James Kirk, death of George Kirk, and that whole drama. It just kills me every time I see it. And that's not even on this list. I mean, I guess we should go down the list as we go, but if you're waiting for the Trek 09 prologue, it's not here at all.
Yeah, it's not here. All right. Well, let's do. Yeah, I knew that for you that was your number one there. Number 10 is the death of David Marcus, and does that one cause tears to well up in your eyes, Greg?
It is a powerful moment. I probably would have put this one higher up in the list because it is a powerful moment. As he describes Kirk stumbling out of the captain's chair and just stunned that this son he didn't even know about but was becoming close with and realized that he meant a lot to him, and now he's just gone senselessly. Mm-hmm. It is a powerful moment, and it is something that makes Star Trek III one of my favorite Star Trek films, even though for some reason people think it's one of the worst. It is fantastic, and then this is one of the powerful moments from that film.
Yeah, I would agree. It is a touching moment, especially because it's a situation that we haven't really seen Kirk have to deal with before.
Yeah.
I mean, the end of Wrath of Khan with Spock dying, yes, but then Kirk dealing with a family member.
Yeah.
I don't know. And So number 9 is the Zindi killing Trip's sister. And I don't know, this one for me is not a tearjerker at all, because we don't actually see the Zindi kill Trip's sister or anything. Right. It's just the fact that her sister happened to be in Florida when the Zindi attacked Earth. So
I mean, there's a touching scene. I don't even think it's in the season opener, but there's one where Trip is talking to somebody about it, and it is a pretty touching scene. And you do remember that this is why they go after the Zindi, because, you know, there were people there, and it was a, you know, and it personally affected our crew and all that stuff. I don't know if it's a big tearjerker moment, as you say, because it's not built up to emotionally. You know, it's not like we even really heard about his sister before that moment anyway. It's not like they attacked Florida. I'm like, oh my God, Trip's sister is down there.
Yeah, we're not invested in that at that point.
Right.
Yeah. So Well, number 8, Mark's Dear John letter.
Right.
Which is to Janeway, right?
Mark. Poor Mark.
No, I always wondered about that. Mark essentially got stuck with the dog, right?
He did, yes. That's essentially the start of the start of Encounter at Farpoint is her saying goodbye to Mark. You know, like, take care of the dog. I'll be back soon. And then
Encounter at Farpoint.
Encounter at Farpoint. Encounter at the caretaker array.
That's right. Okay.
No, you're right. The Voyager pilot, which was called Caretaker.
Yes. But
that was one of those. Anyway, that was the scene where we saw Mark, and then Mark never really is brought up again. Until this moment in season, which season is it? It's 6 or 7.
Yeah, I don't even
remember.
When
they're finally making contact with Earth, and she gets the Dear John letter.
Yeah, I think Mark is mentioned a couple of times, but it's definitely something that's quickly abandoned. You know, she's not pining over Mark for the first season of Voyager or anything like that. So, okay, well, number 7, Scotty's nephew.
Now, the Scotty's nephew is a moment that annoys me, because he brings his nephew to the bridge. Not sick bay, the bridge. And it's just one of those things that emotionally it works, but when you're actually watching the film and it happens, it's like, wait, why? What? And on top of that, they cut the scene earlier in the film where Scotty's like talking to his nephew and he's all proud that his nephew's there on the ship. So it's just Scotty showing up with this guy who's burned on the bridge.
That's right. You don't know. In the original cut, you didn't quite know what was going on there, right? It's only later when it was filled in and you in the scene where you actually learn that it's Scotty's nephew. Does it make more sense?
I guess there's a director's cut or something, or at least people have seen the deleted scene, and it's become less of that sort of moment and better. But it's still, every time I see it, it strikes just this weird wrong chord to me.
Yeah.
But like I say, emotionally it does work. It is this moment of this battle is actually taking its toll, and often we don't see that. We just see sparks flying and people, you know, flying over desks.
Do you think that the turbo lift accidentally took Scotty to the bridge instead of sick bay?
Well, it was that accent that Doohan's trying to do, you know, take me to the sick bay. He can't because he's blubbering and he's trying to do the accent, and you know, it comes out as the bridge when the computer actually hits it.
So basically, they were using like Dragon Dictate to operate the turbo lifts on.
Every once in a while, I'll send you an iMessage, and it will just be completely, completely wrong because I was dictating it. And I just assumed, I'm sure that went through correctly, but it just got you know, 3 words completely wrong and completely garbled my meaning.
Well, that happens to me too. Siri does not like my accent. You know, I mean, I have to set it to American English or British English or Australian English, which certainly is not applicable to me.
Right.
But my accent doesn't fit American English profile well enough for Siri to be accurate. And some of the stuff that she thinks I'm saying is just bizarre.
Yeah, it's crazy. I can just mumble something into it and it'll be perfect. And then I'll be very clear and it'll be completely wrong. So it's slapdash. But yes, it definitely needs a Gaijin English setting for people like you who have been in Japan too long.
Yeah, for sure. That's what we need. All right. Well, moving on to number six, we have Spock meets Spock Prime. So yes. This is our entry from the 2009 J.J. Abrams movie.
This is the moment they picked, or he picked, from the 09 film. Not the moment where Kirk is born. Not the moment where we learn that the entire Starfleet has been destroyed. Not the moment where Vulcan explodes. No, the moment in a hangar deck in what feels like a deleted scene that snuck its way back into the film. It's Spock.
It does
feel
like a deleted scene, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah. I don't know. I think that is for a lot of Star Trek fans, is a touching moment because of seeing Leonard Nimoy back there. I would agree that it's very touching, not because Spock is meeting Spock. It's just touching knowing that that's probably the last time that Leonard Nimoy is going to, you know, raise his hand there. So I can agree on that in that respect. I will agree with you that I think that the birth of Kirk is a much more tear-jerking and touching moment in the movie.
Right. But I see what you're saying. As far as meta, I'm realizing this is Leonard Nimoy. And this is
for the
be
fan,
his,
yeah.
For the as far as a fan, I can see that being true, but as far as in universe, I think there were some more emotional.
And I believe that Jordan actually says in the column, right, that that is also a touching moment. But
yes.
He was kind of nervous about putting two entries from the new film onto a top 10 list, right?
Well, that's the thing of the JJ film is that there was so much in it that was emotional and powerful. And I think you could just make a top 10 list of just the emotional moments in the 09 Trek film. So I understand he wanted to pick one and he wanted to just make it the one that meant the most to him. And if Nimoy's final salute, if Quinto having to adjust his hand below the camera and then sort of raise it up, try to hold on to that salute as long as possible. If that was what was most emotionally powerful to him, more power to him. I understand.
Yeah. All right. Well, number five is Sulu swoops in. Now, this is not about Mirror Mirror when he's hitting on Uhura, is it?
The moment in the naked now when he's or the naked time when he's running around the ship with the saber.
Swooping in on everyone.
Takei does a lot of swooping. This is what we're trying to say.
All right. Let's move on through the list. I won't talk too much about that one. Number four, alternate reality, old Jake Sisko. I'll agree with this one because I think that The Visitor is one of the most touching of all Star Trek episodes, along with maybe The Inner Light. And I'm not sure what else from the series. The Visitor is really a tear-jerking episode, I would say.
The Visitor is probably an episode I've only actually seen once when I saw it in sequence, and I think I do need to go back and watch it again. I'm remembering it because it was one of the better episodes. It's one of those ones that's it's not a serialized one. It's more of a standalone episode, and it is one of those really powerful ones that when you're watching it on DVD and you're watching, you know, five episodes in a day, maybe it just goes past you.
Mm-hmm. It is one of the best Star Trek episodes, I think, of all of the series combined. So, yeah, you should go back and watch that one.
Definitely.
All right, number three, the Resican flute.
Right, with the 7.1 surround sound flute action.
That's right. It was tear-jerking. On Blu-ray, it's really going to be tear-jerking.
You haven't heard until there's the chorus of flutes.
So what is the Resican flute, actually?
The Resican flute. Okay, so this was the episode, right, where Picard has this whole, or he's sort of downloads a life experiences. Like these aliens give him the experience of...
So the Resican flute is the actual flute from the Inner Light.
From the Inner
That's
Light,
the type,
yes.
Yeah, flute. So it is going to be 7.1.
Exactly.
Tear-jerking power coming up. All right.
Exactly.
I had forgotten the actual name there of the flute. But yeah, okay. Yeah, I'll
give
you that.
Yeah, the flute. Yeah, it's the moment at the end of the episode where Picard's like, oh, you know, I'm fine. You know, whatever. I have, you know, 60 years of life memories. I'm just going to move on. But then he goes back to his quarters and plays the flute. And you're like,
yeah.
Yeah. He's messed up now. He had a lot of sessions with Troy after that episode to try to deal with those emotions.
Right.
And the sense of loss.
Those are all in the Next Generation B-side collection that we're hoping they're going to release. Everything else that was going on the ship that we didn't see during the series.
One of these days.
All right. So number two, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few or the one.
Or the one. Yes.
Yeah. This is referring to the death scene of Spock in Star Trek II.
Yes. And this is a powerful, powerful moment. Yeah. Ever since I was a kid, this has really killed me. Even again, Shatner having difficulty doing the Vulcan salute for the second time on this list. It kills me. Even knowing, spoiler that Spock comes back.
Great. Thanks for that spoiler alert there, Greg.
And this is part of what made me angry in Transformers 3, where Nimoy is playing an evil character and he sort of turns around this, where he says, the needs of the one outweigh the needs of the many. And then he like punches somebody in the face.
Yeah.
It's like, really? Did you have to like go and destroy my childhood? Is that really what you had to do?
Well, I will say for me, this is probably number one on my list. If I think back of, what are the most touching moments in Star Trek for me, there are a number of them, but there aren't so many that like really, really stick in my head that I would immediately think of. But this is the one, the when Spock actually dies at the end of the Wrath of Khan.
Yeah.
This and the when they launch the torpedo with Spock.
Right.
And they have the bagpipes and Kirk gives the speech. That's the other moment. So related.
Yeah. Yeah. That's. Yeah, it's definitely number one on the list. But what did this guy put down as his number one? What do we have here?
So Jordan put down as number one the quote, "He knows, Doctor, he knows."
Right, and of course that's from The City on the Edge of Forever, which is I mean if you're going back to TOS episodes that were emotionally powerful, City on the Edge of Forever is the one. And out of all the people that Kirk fell in love with over the course of an episode, and then either just left or they managed to die, Edith Keeler is the one that you got to think he was still thinking about 30 years later.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. All right. Well, that wraps up his list. Now, real quick, Greg, let me ask you, tear jerking can mean something's very sad, but also sometimes you do shed tears from excessive laughter as well. So tell me quickly here, on the flip side of tear-jerking moments in Star Trek, what are a few of your most tear-jerking moments? You already mentioned the release of Star Trek V.
Right. So you're asking me what things made me the most uproarious laughter came from me. Yes, so the release of Star Trek V, the ending of Threshold.
I knew that was going to be there.
Trying to think of what else. The entrance of Kirk in pretty much any of the TOS films, in most of them he's backlit, he's sucking in his gut.
Yeah.
Those are great moments. There's not an awful lot funny I can think of at the moment. There are actual legitimate funny episodes. There's one that I'm trying to remember that was early on in Next Gen. For some reason, they decided to make it a funny episode. Like, it's weird because it's
sandwiched. Oh, I know. You're talking about The Last Outpost, right?
See, The Last Outpost and episodes like that weren't intended to be funny.
Right.
And then they managed to be. And then they made an actual self-aware funny episode. And it's easy to get them confused. It's the one, if you remember, where Geordi is in the turbolift and everything's going crazy and he gets thrown around the turbo lift, like he flies to the ceiling, he's on the side, and it's a hilarious moment. And then he shows up on the bridge and Picard's like, what took you so long? And if you don't that episode recently just had me rolling.
Well, I think for me, the two that you mentioned, the ending of Threshold and the release of Star Trek V could be one. Captain Claw is one, of course. And also the Ferengi jumping around wearing fur and banging whips in The Last Outpost.
Right.
I've always loved the plant that Sulu keeps in his quarters, the hand in a pink glove.
Oh, right.
Squeezed back and forth. I don't know.
Here's what I was going to say. Any moment between Brent Spiner and the cat, because you can tell Spiner hates the cat hates Spiner, the director is yelling at both of them, and everyone just wants to move on. It's especially the end of Generations where he finds Spot. It's supposed to be this emotional tearjerker moment, but Spiner's literally holding the cat 6 feet away from him. You know, saying, "Troy, can you please take this cat away from me?"
All right, I know. All right. Well, as you said, everyone wants to move on. So why don't we move on as well? I'm just a love machine, and I won't work for nobody but you. I'm just a love machine. Yeah, baby. A hug and kiss and feed. La, 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 la. All right, Greg. I hear that we do have some movie news this week, including, as that clip suggested, some news about Uhura and Spock. From Zoe Saldana, apparently, and this is breaking news, she has revealed that Spock and Uhura will be in the next movie.
Yes. Spock and Uhura will be in the next movie. I guess we kind of have confirmed that they're not dropping the relationship aspect, which I don't know that anyone was thinking they might. I do find it interesting that we have two stories. The next one we're coming up on is Nimoy's going to visit the set. I do hope he's there for some sort of encounter scene between Spock and Uhura. I just imagine Nimoy sitting there saying, this is not right. Why are they doing this? Shaking his head as they're...
Okay. I wasn't quite sure where you were going with that, but okay.
Oh, no. Crossing I don't think Spock universes. Prime should come. Oh my goodness. Wow.
All right. Yeah, so this story kind of got a lot of play here and there. Over the past few days, she was talking to Vulture, which is a blog from the New York Times. Is that right?
I
believe so.
New York. I think it's just New York Magazine.
New York Magazine. Yeah, that's right. And they asked her about Star Trek II and, you know, what was going on. And yeah, basically, as you said, she just kind of hinted that the relationship between Spock and Uhura will continue in the next movie.
Right.
And, you know, I think we talked about this before on here that in a way, I guess I would be disappointed if it didn't continue, because then it would just seem like something they threw in the last movie to make the timeline different. And if it's just suddenly not there anymore in the next movie, it would seem kind of odd. So,
yeah, definitely.
That's good.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to the subplot where Spock and her are new parents. And, you know, they have to carry the baby around on the bridge because, you know, this is the original Enterprise and there's no crew quarters for families. So Uhura sort of has to carry the baby and, you know, she's trying to do the talking to the other ships and the baby's crying and Kirk is saying, you know, make that baby shut up, you know, get off my bridge.
She's going to have the little backpack thing, right?
Yes. She
the baby in the back. Yeah. Yeah. And that will also be in red, I assume, to match her uniform. Now, that brings up a good question, Greg. Now, do they get their own communicators? Or, I mean, because how do you know where they are?
This is a
good
point.
Now, of course, in the original series, the Insignia were not communicators. Right. But in the last comic, Abrams' first comic, Kirk did tap his badge to call the ship. So they may be going the TNG route. And if so, I mean, Neelix got a communicator badge.
He did get a little communicator. I'm now, Chris, imagining the most adorable little jumpsuit for the baby. We really need to name the Spock Uhura baby. But I just imagining, you know, it's just a little uniform. It's got the little insignia on it. It's got little, you know, it's got the incorporated feet. It's got a zipper up the back because it's, you know, for a baby. Maybe a little hood.
Little black boots also, like Uhura.
Little black boots. Aww.
Oh, all right. Maybe that'll be a good poll for us to have. What would you name Spock and Uhura's baby?
Add this to the list of titles, you know, Uhura's baby.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, you already mentioned the next little bit of movie news here. Nimoy visiting the set of Star Trek, what I'm calling Star Trek 2013.
That's probably the best way to put it.
Two, and I've noticed a lot of people searching for it under that term as well on Google these days. But this is a interesting story because as time goes on, you know, we want to find a way to dispel a lot of these rumors. And at least this one, we know he's going to go to the set. Now, he tweeted that he's going there, and it seems obvious that he's not actually going to be appearing in the movie.
Right.
As a character,
right.
Which means that we can just finally dispel all those rumors about Leonard Nimoy playing Khan.
We definitely can. I think it's definitely shown he can't do it. His pecs aren't astonishing enough anymore, and he can't do Khan. Unfortunately, they had to cast, you know, someone else to do that, which is why Alice Eve is in the next film.
That's right.
I'd also,
because she's got the pecs for it, right?
She does. While we're dispelling rumors, I also want to dispel any rumors that Nichelle Nichols will be joining the film to play Uhura Prime in the Spock Prime, Uhura Prime wedding scene that was supposed to be the climax of the film. That's actually been cut for basically budgetary reasons.
Right. Yeah, I heard they were doing that, and it was going to be a big thing, but they wanted to get kind of a... J.J. Abrams felt that the writing team, you know, of Roberto Orci and Lindelof and everyone, it was just a little bit too close to the project, and they wanted to go get an outside opinion on that. So they called up Stuart Baird, and they said, Stuart, look, we've got this wedding scene that we're going to put in the Star Trek movie, and what do you think we should do? Do you think we should keep it in? And Stuart's going, no, you got to cut that. No one cares about the wedding scene.
Cut
it's slowing
wedding.
Down the movie. It's just, but it doesn't make any sense. No one wants to see it. Let's just cut that out.
Whatever you do, make sure that Wesley will be cut when you do the pan and scan version. I want to make sure that only the people who see the film in the theaters will see Wesley.
Yeah. All right. So what else is going on with the movie here, Greg? Anything else worth talking about here?
What else going on is that the script is still evolving, which you have to expect, because there is no Writers Guild strike, thankfully. So they're still working on the film. They'll probably still be working on it until the film is actually released and they've put their last polish of ADR, you know, re-recorded dialogue on the film. So yes, I'm sure they have the basics of it down, but Quinto said that everything is still evolving. They've been shooting, he said, for a week and a half at this point. I guess at this point it's been 2.5 weeks since they've actually been shooting.
Yeah, something like that.
And we
yeah.
still have no details on the plot, really.
Yeah, it is amazing that in this day and age of Twitter and all the other online, all the blogs and everything, that nothing has leaked out so far. I'm a little bit surprised.
Very surprising. And I still look forward to that. I can't wait to see. I can't wait to see what it is. Have you seen a picture of Quinto recently with the Spock hair and the shaved eyebrows? I'm assuming he doesn't wear the ears in public.
No, I haven't seen a picture yet. If you were playing that role, would you wear the ears in public?
Well, I mean, if I'm already going to have the shaved eyebrows, I might as well just leave my makeup eyebrows, you know, pointed up. I might as well leave the ears on. Might as well leave my dumb haircut. You know, if I have to, like, go somewhere and look respectable, I can just, you know, rip my robe and put a headband on. But I think that's much better than just looking like... Looking like, I don't know, a reject from the 70s.
I'm just picturing you with the headband on, heading into the restaurant.
Yes.
Oh, so, no, I haven't seen the picture yet.
Well, I mean, Chris, you've seen the picture of Daniel Day-Lewis as Lincoln. You know, he's such a method actor that he's actually been going around after and before the shoots, dressed as Lincoln with his Lincoln beard on, acting like Lincoln, you know, ordering food as Lincoln. And I, I think it would be fantastic if Quinto was doing the same thing. You know, he goes into McDonald's and they ask him if he'd like to supersize it. And he says, you know, fascinating.
Well, I think it would be great if he did the same thing and he hung out with Chris Pine and then they encountered Lincoln. And
I'm seeing a great crossover here.
Yes, 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 yes. All right. Well, let's see. We have a couple more little bits of news here. We have, there was a tweet that came out from Locations Hollywood that was talking about locations for the Star Trek movie that are in use. And then the tweet was retracted, at least part of it anyway, was retracted a bit later. But they tweeted that Star Trek filming on location, Budweiser Brewery, Sony Studios, Dodger Stadium, Long Beach City Hall, MCAS Tustin, and the Vasquez Rocks. So the first thing that I thought here was, oh, the Budweiser Brewery, because mm-hmm. we've talked about how engineering is supposed to be changed. And then the next thing that I thought was that I think I finally know what the plot is. They're doing a retelling in the Abramsverse timeline of the DS9 episode, Take Me Out to the Hollow Suite.
Oh, that
why else
perfect.
Would they be okay. going to Dodger Stadium? They need a baseball stadium.
Indeed. I don't know. It sounds quite interesting. I look forward to seeing that, I suppose. But this was retracted, and so I don't know how much of this we can take as canon. I mean, I expect they're going to the Vasquez Rocks. I mean, how could you avoid doing that? I don't know why you'd be going to Dodger Stadium. I can't imagine Dodger Stadium still being around in 200 years, especially after a couple world wars.
Well, it is Los Angeles, and as we know, you know, like the Eugenics War, for example, apparently didn't affect Los Angeles. So
that is
maybe
true.
There's some kind of protective bubble around the City of Angels that we don't know about. I wonder if this Long Beach City Hall is what we were hearing about several months ago when they were talking about using a building somewhere in the Los Angeles area,
possible.
You know, for a location that Star Trek fans would be familiar with.
Right. Well, this is definitely something to be watching when we get actual confirmation.
And it could be that they just went to the Budweiser Brewery, you know, to have a drink after shooting.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, after a long night of dealing with Chris Pine. I'm starting a rumor that Chris Pine is a difficult actor to work with.
Oh, really?
So, by all accounts, he's a great guy, but I just think it's hilarious that he'd be like really difficult and ornery and annoying.
Okay, so you're officially starting this rumor and you're expecting it to take hold. And are you going to start a hashtag like Chris Pine is a difficult actor to work with as a hashtag on Twitter and you're going to get that trending,
that's,
right?
That's going to take most of the tweet just to put in a hashtag. So I don't know. I might have to shrink it down a little bit.
I see.
We'll see what I can come up with.
So on last week's show, we talked about one of the favorite aliens in Star Trek that popped up in an unexpected place, and that was the coda to Blood Fever, There Be Borg Here. Well, Voyager certainly had its share of the Borg, but when Enterprise came around, there was an even more controversial moment when the Borg appeared in the episode Regeneration. It's something that really stirred up the fan base, and we're going to talk about that today. And of course, I have Greg with me, and we have back with us, friend of the show, Michael Fisher. Welcome, Michael.
Gentlemen, thank you for having me again. Good to see you.
All right. So I take it, Michael, that you have not yet been assimilated by cyborgs from the past, present, or future, right?
No, thanks to the extended northeastern winter, I am already as pale as a Borg, and they don't even see me as a target. Yeah.
I just noticed that you're wearing all black there, so you made me nervous for a minute. And I also see that you're wearing a comm badge. And
you're gonna call me out as the nerdiest guy on the podcast today. Yes, I am. I am donning one of the what was it? It was the Blu-ray, the Star Trek 09 Blu-ray, that special edition that came with the
oh, did it come
right.
with
now, is
it?
That,
oh.
Yeah, is that one of the comm badges from the movie that is or? It's just a badge, or is it one of the ones from the latest comic that you actually tap, like a Next Generation comm badge, to speak with people?
Does that happen? Do they
do that in the latest comic?
Come on, guys.
Kirk taps his comm badge to call the ship. Yeah.
For real? That's as lame as retconning the badges in yesterday's Enterprise into comm badges. I thought that was a really big sell. But we're not talking about that today.
So is that one of those that are made by Anovos?
No. Oh, God. Have you guys talked about Anovos today? I love Anovos.
Not today, but we talked about them in the past, right? And I saw they were promoting their badges the other day somewhere. I saw really cool-looking badges.
I can't wait until they come out with, whatever their next uniform is going to be, because I'm thinking very heavily about going to the Vegas convention, and I would love to be dressed better than in better threads than a Ruby's tunic.
Nice. You know? Yeah. Nice. Well, if you do go to the Las Vegas convention, I hope that you will wear your uniform and then ask Ron Moore for me about the ending of Generations.
Why don't you come with me? It'll be fun. We'll take a field trip. It'll be fun. We'll live tweet it.
Well,
nice.
I should warn you that Greg is planning to attend all Star Trek conventions wearing Troy's lavender jumpsuit with his hair up in a bun.
I just remembered. I got something.
So if you're okay, walking around with him like that, then I'm sure he'd be happy to join you.
Thank you. You're not going to do the blue one with the crooked like boob line? You're not going to do that?
Yeah. I like the V-neck.
Good for you, man. Stay strong. I like it.
All right, guys. Well, why don't we talk about the Enterprise episode Regeneration
a little bit.
It's a very interesting episode for me because of the way that it stirred up the fan base. Now, I think it wasn't long before this one where they did what I do think was kind of a bad move on Enterprise of bringing the Ferengi on to the show, which, I don't know, didn't quite work. But this one's a little bit different for me. You know, I have mixed feelings about this episode. Overall, I quite like it. What do you guys think about it?
I wanted to bring up at just the very start, the beginning of the show, which is the entire Act One, takes place on Earth with none of our regulars. It's crazy. Like, how many times have they ever done that on Star Trek? I can't think of many at all.
It got to it rung a bell for me too, because all of a sudden when the Enterprise showed up, I had to look at the time code and it was past 10 minutes. It was more than 10 minutes into the episode. Couldn't believe it.
It's what I call the "Where the hell is the Enterprise crew" part of the show. You know, the only other part I can think of is the Voyager episode Distant Origin, where the show opens with these aliens that are descended from the dinosaurs on Earth.
Right.
And we don't see the Voyager cast at all until, I want to say it's even longer than this. I think it's almost 20 minutes into the episode.
I think you're right. That might be the other one like that.
Any of our main characters,
I think. But it's an interesting scene. You know, it's an act out of another show. It reminds me a lot of the film The Thing, where there's sort of researchers who find this sort of dark secret and it kills them.
Yes.
So it's very much The Thing homage, I believe, at the beginning.
What is?
Where they find this Borg sphere broken up.
That was the intention that Brendan Braga had actually there.
Oh, okay. So you listened to Thing. This is something we should mention. You listened to their commentary. Who was actually on that commentary?
It's Mike Sussman and Phyllis Strong, who are the writers of Regeneration. And there is a very good commentary on the... I had thought it was only on the fan collective Borg edition, but I did find that it's actually on the regular Enterprise DVD set for season 2 as well, commentary. But it's a really interesting commentary in which they talk about their ideas for the show, the fan complaints about the show, and kind of their justifications for, why certain things are done the way they are here.
That sounds like an interesting thread. I thought that I mentioned that very long lead-in time to the episode to my roommate who was watching it with me, and I feel like Star Trek uses that very sparingly, maybe, for whatever reason that is, but when they do use it, it tends to be because they're leading into something really epic. And very early in this episode, I got the sense that this was going to be a very cinematic style episode. Mm-hmm. I mean, I got a very best of both worlds, kind of ominous, foreboding, very slow paced, kind of, but gradually accelerating pace, right, evident in the first few minutes even. And I got the feeling I was watching something very different. Especially for Enterprise. And it took me about 7 or 8 minutes just to find the damn episode in the Netflix queue, because I didn't think it was a second season episode.
Yep, precisely.
I was blown away when I found out this was a second season episode, because as most people will agree, the first and second seasons of Enterprise were they're comparatively weaker than the latter ones. So what a
I would have assumed this was a season 5 episode.
Yeah, no, it's true.
It really is. What I liked about, you know, you're talking about that long lead-in. If you watch Next Gen Season 2, I think every single episode starts with the same shot of the Enterprise-D flying towards the camera in space. It's got Picard's voiceover. They're on the bridge. It's the same thing. And then it goes into, here's the introduction, here's the B story. We cut between the two. This is an episode that has one plot thread through the whole thing.
That's very
it
true.
Starts on Earth. It meets up with the crew. They chase after. There's no B story in this episode. You know, maybe the thing with Phlox getting infected is a B story of sorts, but it's still
directly results from the A story. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's one of the more focused episodes of Star Trek that I've ever seen. And I love that. The whole opening sequence is just scene, just building the suspense. You know, as a viewer, what's coming. It's very much, you know, the Borg under the table. Or you know that this is bad, as they're just sort of saying, oh, we don't need to put him in cold storage. Let's just let him sit there. It's like,
how many times does that happen?
Yeah, why? And why would they be hostile? We have no reason to believe that they're hostile.
They have a gun for an arm.
Just because his arm is a rocket launcher doesn't mean he's evil. That's racist.
No, it's true. Like, it happens 3 times in the episode, I think. It's like Ensign Foster or whoever down there in the Arctic Circle, and then Phlox. Like, oh, there's no reason to just assume they're hostile. What's the matter with you?
Right.
Look at him.
Look at him.
Like, yeah, maybe, I mean, just looks like a normal guy. I mean, I'd have a drink with him.
Right.
I let him date my daughter.
I feel like as the episode, like even in this early part of the episode, we start to get elements of, I don't want to say Hitchcockian really, but almost, you know, these really classic horror film elements you know, the bodies kind of gradually making sounds just every so often. Then you get this poor sap, one of the research teams, sitting with his back to these kind of suspicious corpses that they know are fixing themselves inside. I'm like, come on, man, don't do that. And I was glad that nobody snuck it. The episode didn't go there. It was like, oh, this is going to be predictable. Like, you know, he spilled his coffee and then he went over. And did anybody else get a little, like, seriously kind of creeped out when the flat lines on the life sign indicators started spiking?
Yeah. And the worrying. When the
arm
little bit on the arm just starts going by itself, and there's that close up.
Oh, chills.
I was like, oh. And then they go over and there's like the pulse, and then two, and then he's like opens his eyes and breathes in. It's like, oh crap, it's great.
And is there,
totally makes up for all of the fake snow and the wooden acting.
It does. It automatically saves the episode like 5 minutes in. But then that guy immediately loses all of his rights to live, because, you know, this Borg is just gasping and reactivating. And what does he do? Like, he sticks his face way down, right in his nose. And the next thing we hear is him screaming. And it's like, of course, man. Get your face away from the friggin' scary-looking monster.
Right. Surely, I mean... Surely there's some sedative you could just immediately administer.
Right.
You had some backup plan, right? You had
Have your gun out. Like, you had your gun before. Like, get it. Yeah.
Right.
Well, see, in later Star Trek series, they've always got a hypo spray on hand. And if something like that happens, you just stick it in the neck and
it's true.
The person's out.
It's true.
Yeah. So, Greg, I remember you tweeting that you wondered if people who make fake snow have ever seen real snow, right?
It's so, really bad in this episode. So I mean, I love bad. The CG effect of the snow and the snow falling looks good, but the snow on the ground is just this weird fluff that you can tell isn't wet at all.
it's like shredded newspaper.
Terrible.
Well, yeah, I will say though, because I lived in Nevada for 4 years, the snow that we get in Reno and Lake Tahoe is so dry. You cannot make a snowball out of it. If you try to roll it into a snowball, it just falls back to the ground. So there are different types of snow as well.
Okay.
Now, well, I don't know what the snow is like up in the Arctic Circle, so but I'm used to this very, very dry snow myself.
Right.
But the snow falling, this is one thing that I liked on Enterprise, both here and in Broken Bow, when they go to Rigel 10, I think it is that right? The snow that's falling was, I always thought was one of the great kind of outdoor type scenes in Star Trek compared to the earlier series. You could tell that the CGI technology had advanced so much when they started doing Enterprise.
Yeah, definitely.
Looked a lot more
and
real.
This wasn't too much longer after they started learning how to do random movement elements like that. Like they could do water really well, only starting about 1998 or something like that. And this was only four years later. So yeah, snow. Yeah. Like I feel like water, snow, and fire, and those kind of things were really tough to do really late in the CGI game. Even.
Yeah, I mean, it's just you compare. Okay, you're back to TOS and their idea of what an alien world looked like, or any sort of location shoot, even into TNG. Even into Voyager, it never feels like an actual place. And I actually felt like this felt like the Arctic Circle. And it was helped by those wide shots that were CG, even the people were CG. It really made you feel like you were actually in a location, which is something Star Trek always has so much trouble with. And Battlestar was doing it at the same time with their New Caprica. And I don't want to spoil the later episodes, but those feel like actual locations as well. And it's amazing to see what TV is able to do at this point. And it's great that Enterprise was right there with it.
I completely agree. Yeah, and you have the giant structural element the biggest piece of debris in the field, which kind of shows you the component of the sphere. And it's like, oh, wow, you can actually see the outer hull here.
Yeah, which is really interesting point. Do you know what that giant circular-like piece of debris was?
Well, I'm cheating. I have memory alpha. But
I have not cheated about. So
it
go ahead
the,
and inform me.
It is the saucer section from the Enterprise E.
Oh, I see.
That was created for the crash sequence in Nemesis.
I see.
So strange.
And it just, I don't even, now that I know
you don't
that,
really
I,
notice
it still doesn't
that
make,
though.
Wow.
Yeah.
No, it totally just reads as Borg.
It's just big, there's like circular type debris filled there. So
nice.
Yeah.
All right. Well, speaking of the Borg themselves, now how do you guys feel about the Borg appearing on Enterprise in the first place? Because the biggest controversy here amongst the fan base was the idea that the Borg belonged to the 24th century, not the 22nd century. So how dare the writers put the Borg on Enterprise? It's like, oh, you don't have any ideas. You're going to take the Borg who were popular in the 24th century and bring them back here. Because, I've criticized Voyager before for going to the Romulans really quickly in season one, for example. Mm-hmm. That it's like, grasping onto the familiar race instead of creating something new. Mm-hmm. But in this case, Borg on Enterprise, and of course the writers, Mike Sussman and Phyllis Strong, have talked about, to them anyway, this episode is a sequel to First Contact. So how do you feel about Borg appearing on this prequel series that comes before everything else?
I will say this. I heard about this episode. This was the second season of Enterprise, so I was in college and I was getting into shows and doing rehearsals and things, so I couldn't watch it and there were no DVRs. So I heard that this episode was happening and I was like, really? I said many of the same things you just said, Chris. I was like, this is ridiculous. It's only season two. They have no ideas of their own. What are they doing? This is a very desperate, foolish thing. And I was angry, I think, to hear about it was done. And I didn't see the episode until maybe a couple months ago for the first time. It was a long time. But when I saw the episode, I think the finished product, frankly, is so good. It's such a good episode of Enterprise, but also of Star Trek. I mean, it's one of the better Star Trek episodes I've seen of this type. That, you can break whatever rules you want as long as you do it well. And for me, this episode, much like Insurrection for a lot of people, is like a giant episode. It doesn't really deserve to be a movie. I feel like this episode of Enterprise is so big and so broad in its concept and so good in its execution that it almost feels like a miniature Star Trek movie to me. So I love how it turned out, but I was very, very skeptical at first.
Yeah, interesting. I just tend to think of all the other things that we have bought into, you know, Kor Kang and Koloth showing up on DS9, the plot of the origin of the motion picture, where it's V'ger is Voyager, which is a spaceship that came anyway. The coincidences that we're supposed to just go along with in Star Trek, I don't think this is much of a stretch. I really don't. I think this is like we were talking, like Brian was talking about on, I believe it was Blood Oath, where this is what you do. I think anyway, this is what you do. You connect your series. You have two elements, and you're doing a prequel show. I think this is what he was talking about. You do a prequel show. You really do a prequel show so you can do episodes like this. You know, you had the Borg come in First Contact. You know, what happened? What happened to that ship? And, you know, obviously by the 24th century, that debris is going to be gone, or they're going to have found it. You can't do a Voyager episode about the Borg debris field. Mm-hmm. So you go back to Enterprise. This is the perfect time to do it. And as Michael said, it's so perfectly done. It's really great. I think this could have been a two-parter or a two-hour-long TV movie.
Easily.
Oh, yeah, it could have been. Yeah, I agree that if they just had the Enterprise NX-01 out in space somewhere and they encountered the Borg, it wouldn't have worked because that would have been, you know, there would have been records, right, of this. But in this case, because of what I like about Star Trek, especially, I think we've talked about this before too, say compared to Star Wars, where you have only six movies and then a bunch of, you know, non-canon books that most people haven't read. In Star Trek, you have this absolutely enormous universe. You know, I mean, it's the whole galaxy. There's stuff going on all over the place. You've got a timeline, which of course people have traveled backward and forward, but there's so much depth to it and everything ties together. And the way that they handled bringing the Borg back on here and tying it into First Contact, to me, it's what Star Trek's all about. It's the fact that there are some cause and effects, or there are consequences to things that happen. Now, when in the Next Generation, your head can spin if you try to think about how all this stuff fits on the timeline. But on the Next Generation, so in Q-Who, we meet the Borg for the first time. And of course, they don't know who the Borg are. They don't recognize them. And they only meet them because Q has flung them across the galaxy. But then as the shows go on and on and on, we finally reach the movie First Contact, at which point, at least from our perspective as viewers, the Borg have never been to Earth in the past. Then in that movie, they time travel to the past. Now, of course, your head can spin because there's a loop there, right? Once they've done it, well, then in our history, they did it in the past. So it gets to be very confusing. But the fact that it happened in First Contact means that there could have very likely been debris or even drones left on Earth.
Sure.
And as Phyllis Strong, one of the writers, says on the commentary, you know, there are real-life cases in the Arctic Circle of artifacts that have been uncovered that are, you know, millions of years old because the plate tectonics causes things to, you know, rise up to the surface. So the idea that this debris had been there, of course, we're talking about a short time here, only like 200 years, right? But the fact that maybe it was there, no one really knew, and then it kind of came up to the surface a little bit, it's believable enough that it could happen. And so I like the fact that they actually discussed the consequences of what happened in First Contact to our past in this case. Mm-hmm. And Greg, as you said, during the other side of the room, people are really going to start going to iTunes looking for this other side of the room thing, I think, as often as we mention it here. But as you were mentioning, in effect, Enterprise, the series, takes place in an alternate timeline.
Yes. Did I not mention that on the show yet? Let me go ahead and go into that.
I don't know.
So this is a Zephyrin. This is a world that takes place after First Contact. So the world of Q-Who, the world of the Next Generation, and I think the example I gave you was the original series, had a Zephyrin Cochrane who never met cybernetic men from the future.
Right. Yes.
That this is a future that has been changed. And I don't know how much those ripples have done, but you have to realize that maybe the events... Not sure exactly how to express this properly.
It's confusing, yeah.
It is confusing. It does make your head spin, as you say. But one of the reasons I don't have a problem with this is because it is this sort of alternate universe that maybe later in this universe, when the next generation people meet the Borg, somebody looks in the files and figures out, you know, that they had met them before. It's interesting to see the timeline be shifted in a way like that.
Yeah, we will see that in the J.J. Abrams Star Trek The Next Generation reboot when they remake First Contact.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I feel like the Next Generation crew, you know, regardless of universe, I mean, this is difficult to believe considering the world that we now live in, but, you know, as we were shown in 1987, they're not all that great at space Google. Right? So, like, you know, you see the naked now and like Picard's like reading the things like Constitution class Starship Enterprise. What are you talking about? You know, it's like, come on, man. So I feel like we can't rely on them in any universe to like go back, I guess, and, you know, go back in the records.
I was going to make is that doesn't Riker spend a lot of time just doing Enterprise episodes on the holodeck? We learned that in these Voyagers.
Right. That's right.
Oh, apparently.
Didn't he at some point do the Cybernetic Men from the Future episode? It seems like if you're gonna go hang out with Enterprise crew, this is going to be one of the ones to hang out with them in. In those shots
of the Enterprise D in These Are the Voyages, if you look closely, if you watch it in HD anyway, I think outside the holodeck, there's like a list of like the most frequently accessed programs by each crew member.
Oh, no.
What I find interesting is for Riker, the decontamination room rubdown program is at the top of the list.
It's top of the list, right? As long as it's like T'Pol and Hoshi are in there. Yeah.
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 Decontamination room, T'Pol's quarters.
He had a little squint hole put in there for him to squint through.
Rigel 10. Anywhere he can shoot a gun or be rubbed down with gel. That's where William Riker is.
That's what WT is all about.
While we're on this tack of it being sort of disliked by fans at the beginning, it is important to remember this came after two episodes. One was from the first season, the end of the first season. The second was from the beginning of the second season. That was Acquisition and Minefield. And those are two episodes where the Ferengi show up. But they're not the Ferengi. They're unidentified capitalistic species. And then in Minefield, it's the Romulans. But it's not the Romulans. It's the unidentified species with the cloaking device. Mm. And so then you get onto here, and it's unidentified cybernet. And for God's sakes, guys, do we have to have another unidentified race from the Next Generation showing up on Enterprise? Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, part of why there's the backlash.
Yeah, even in here, when they encounter the Borg ship, the Borg come on and they just say, "You will be assimilated."
Right.
They don't say, "We are the Borg, you will be assimilated."
Right.
They don't say, "We're the Borg" in Q-Who either.
Right. The first time they meet Picard, they don't say it.
And my theory is that Hoshi just didn't push the button fast enough.
Probably.
They were already broadcasting.
The Borg, click, you will be assimilated.
Yeah.
Probably, you know. It happens to me sometimes when I'm recording here. Mm-hmm. Like, I'll hit record. If I start talking immediately, sometimes, like, that first second, just it doesn't record. Mm-hmm.
Totally understandable.
Probably situation like
we're
that.
We're going to blame this on Hoshi then, yeah.
Yeah, it's all Hoshi's fault.
Okay, good. Yeah. Bluetooth earpiece wearing Hoshi.
Yeah. Yeah, doesn't that look like they, like,
care.
They, like, ran down to Target and grabbed a... one of these little like Sony earphones for her earpiece in this episode.
Yeah, it's almost like, it's so toy like. Actually, this episode has a couple good instances of props being kind of interesting because the Arctic guys have the medical instrument that they're using to check out the Borg, which looks kind of like Vulcan almost in a way, in that it's kind of this blown up rounded circular play school kind of thing, and then Hoshi's earpiece. Enterprise has some interesting like scenic design choices that they make. I wanted to ask, actually, before we got off the planet and got to the rest of the plot, Was the Arctic team a Starfleet team?
I don't think so.
I don't think so. Because I was trying to look at their patches.
They actually have a line where they say that Starfleet requested us to investigate this or look into this, something like that. I think at that point, Starfleet is still a small organization, kind of like we would have the military now. And this is just a team of researchers, you know, from some university or somewhere who has an outpost at the Arctic Circle.
They have like badges on
there. They
do.
They've got two patches on there.
I never saw quite what the badges were of.
One of them ends in
Institute. Navy or something.
One of them
did say something Institute?
Institute, but I couldn't like make out the rest of it, and I didn't have time to try a screen grab.
They're probably from the Cetacean Institute.
In Sausalito? A pair of humpback whales named George and Grayson?
Looking for frozen humpback whales.
Yeah, they were up in the Bering Strait looking for them, and then they got called by Starfleet, so they left there, and they just went up to the Arctic Circle to check out this wreckage.
That's probably right, yeah.
They've got a lot of guns with them
for
scientists.
Yeah. Even Reed says it. He's like, they were well-armed. How were they overpowered?
I mean, one problem I had was they sort of set up – they did. They set up bears, like bears as being a threat, and then they never capitalized that on that at all.
Yeah.
Like a bear should have come out of nowhere and eaten a Borg or something if you're going to mention bears. Because then I'm only thinking about bears for the rest
of the
show.
That happens in my short story, Goldie Spock and the Three Bears. Seriously. Yeah. It does.
This is your Chekhov's bear there?
Spock. Yeah.
Chekhov's bear.
What's his name? Ensign Foster, who I keep calling him that because that actor played a character on a game called Silent Steel that I used to play, a computer game.
Oh, okay.
He also had a different communicator, BT Dubs. I don't know if anybody else mentioned that, but noticed that he's got a communicator with a black flip-up grill instead of the usual silver one. Yeah. So I don't know if I've never seen that prop before or since. Maybe the Mako's carried later. I don't know. It doesn't seem like
it's got a black grill on it.
Yeah.
I don't know. Mike, you listen to the Verge cast, right? Don't they call murdering it out?
Oh, yeah.
He has a murdered out communicator.
A murdered out communicator, yeah.
Well, one other thing here while we're talking about the Arctic Circle there that I did want to touch on was the debris itself. And I think some fans have asked in the past why Picard didn't remove the debris. Why did he leave debris at the end of First Contact on the planet, you know, knowing that there might still be Borg there on the planet. And this is another thing that's addressed in the commentary. And they have an idea behind it. Mike Sussman does anyway, his theory behind it. But before I get into that, Greg, what do you think about the fact that Picard left debris behind?
Well, my theory basically is that he was too busy trying to figure out if he was or wasn't having some sort of romantic thing going on with Lily. And that just threw off the whole, you know, thinking straight. I've totally been there. I think you guys have been there where you're so distracted by a girl. You forget to destroy the Borg debris.
I've definitely
so he was a little bit off of his command game there.
He was.
Yeah. Yeah. Because that's what he does, right? Like, there's the kiss on the cheek, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, the movie, like, and First Contact ends like you're kind of going down a really steep slide, where it's like, all right, we got it. All this stuff is wrapped up. This is great. Now we're back in the Enterprise. There's like 45 seconds left. Geordi, say something about the moon. I don't know. Let's just go hide behind something so that the Vulcans don't. Oh, okay, you got that taken care of. All right, good. Let's get out of here. Boom.
There you go.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, it ends. It still ends in the 21st century, doesn't it?
Yes.
Like we sort of see the Enterprise go through the thing, and we never even have an epilogue.
It's back to Ubi Dubi,
the 24th century.
Mm-hmm.
I was always hoping that the next film would open with them returning to the 24th century, and find that they'd screwed everything up. Men are wearing skirts. Humpback whales are dead again.
Well, they got the scants still. I mean, those do still, they're still in the timeline.
That's true.
Oh, speaking of that, I saw a news post on some site. Wasn't actually a Star Trek site, but they were talking about the Blu-ray coming out. And the headline of it was something like, unexpected details show up in Next Generation Remastered. And the person writing it said that someone told them that in the remastered version of Encounter at Farpoint, you can actually see the scant being worn by men in all three division colors. And They said, that alone is worth the price of the disc for me.
Oh, man, absolutely.
I can't believe they made more than one color of that thing.
I know. Wow.
I don't remember any instance of... Yeah.
We're going to have to watch. I bet it's in like some of those new remastered shots of the Enterprise model from space. They've gone in and digitally added some men in scants in the windows.
Push in on a window. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, what is the writer's explanation for Kirk or for Picard's absent-mindedness?
Well, what Sussman says, and I can understand this pretty well. He points out that in the movie, there's, you know, some line about their sensors still being down or something, so maybe they couldn't detect that there was any debris left. But ultimately, Picard would have left the debris there intentionally because he would know that by removing the debris, he would be changing history, because all of this happened and it was supposed to happen this way because it happened. Head spinning again.
All of this happened right and there. Will happen again. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, exactly.
Not to quote the Scrolls of Pythia again on the podcast.
No, we shan't.
But that would be the reason that by removing it, he would then be changing history. I don't know. It's as good an explanation for me as anything else.
But I think the best explanation is you go back to First Contact, and the ship just kind of blows up. Like, yeah. The debris shouldn't really be there technically. So it's really, I don't think there's an in-universe explanation, because in the film, Picard says, blow up that ship. It blows up. Yeah. They move on. In Regeneration, it's sort of been retconned that the ship was like damaged and then flew through the atmosphere and crashed. But that's not exactly what happened on screen.
Well, I think probably the debris came through the atmosphere in very large chunks. We see the ship explode in First Contact, but you do see a rather sizable debris field there. I remember that. Yeah. You know,
but I mean, today, if a satellite loses orbit or breaks up for some reason, there's always concern about the debris coming down as well. So that could work, but
I don't think there was much concern that Borg weren't going to survive
atmospheric reentry and the
atmospheric reentry. Exactly.
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah. But Greg, if there's not an in-universe explanation for this, is there a non-canon novel that explains this?
I'm sure there's going to be, you know. Surely there was someone, probably Kirk from an alternate timeline, living in the Arctic Circle in the 21st century.
Chopping wood.
And he's gonna see them. He's going to have his own encounter with the Borg. We're going to find out that alternate Kirk is the one who put that Borg into the ice, which is why it's such, you know, perfect ice that he's under. It's a great novel. I think you should all read it. Some pocketbooks coming out this fall, $9.99.
Standing.
Also available on Kindle.
Gonna say, can I read it on my pad?
You definitely can. But so we're now, we've left the Arctic Circle and we're finally meeting up with the Enterprise. While we're talking about huge coincidences, the Borg ship went off in a direction from Earth that just happened to intersect with the only Starfleet vessel in existence. That's the leap of logic that takes me a bit much. It's like, yes, they left Earth and they're over there. Look.
Yeah.
Like, look out the window.
They do just kind of cross paths, don't they?
Yeah.
They're not spotted and then they're notified, oh, this is where this renegade ship is, and you need to go there, right?
They got a subspace in Federation. It was like, you know, the azimuth was in your direction. Go check him out. Like, I guess that's extremely lucky, because otherwise the entire human race would have been destroyed.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks, coincidence.
Is the Enterprise... Now, this is something, because Enterprise, like, I need a kind of a refresher. Like, I know Enterprise is the first Warp 5 vessel and all that kind of stuff, but... And it's NX-01. I mean, are there any other Starfleet vessels of any kind? I know Columbia comes
later.
That's
a good point. There are other... we don't see them, I don't think. But there's like Warp 3, Warp 4. I mean, there's freighters.
Like the Mayflowers. Do I remember that or something like that? Or the Mariposa? Or was that a freighter? I don't know.
Something. But there definitely are other... But this is the first one that can...
That could do something.
Really explore.
Yeah.
And so I think it's the only one that's this far away from Earth.
Right.
I guess you're right. It's not the only Starfleet vessel.
Yeah, later we get the NX-02 Columbia, right?
Columbia, but
I has that happened at this point in the second
season? No, the Columbia was...
comes out later, right?
Columbia was made to be more of a warship because of the Zindi. So it was being built at around this time, but it hadn't actually launched yet.
So in the end, they just got really, 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 really lucky.
They basically. Did. Or really unlucky, I guess, depending on if you're Dr. Phlox.
Though Dr. Phlox, I mean, he really was just asking to be assimilated though, right?
That's true.
God, yeah. Well, like immediately before that, they rescue rescue the two Tarkalians. When we see the survey ship for the first time since it's taken off, since it's been stolen by the Borg, and you can see the Borgification of the outer hull, which is so cool, especially think that this was released in 03. And I mean, it still has the hull form, the original shape, but they've added these kind of almost metallic warts to the entire exterior of the ship in this Borgified kind of way. And it's very cool to watch the ship evolve over the course of the episode into a more and more familiar.
I hear the Borg have a really effective cream for that, those metallic warts that they get.
Perhaps you'd like an analgesic cream?
Yeah. Nice. Didn't know Phlox was joining us on this podcast.
They say the original concept for the ship that they had there was that the Borg would add additional ships to a ship over time as they assimilated crews and so forth until they finally built a cube out of it. Like, that's how Borg ships get built. They just kind of, like a snowball, building up more and more snow until they finally take this form. But then they
kind of
abandoned that because they felt it would be too confusing to the audience to have the ship configuration changing in that way.
I feel like they could have done it if it was like a two-parter, like you were saying before, Greg.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Or a movie.
Well, yeah, if it had taken them longer to blow it up, that's obviously the way it's going, because by the end of the episode, I mean, it's not just warts. There's like these huge chunks of Borg stuck to the ship. I think what they ended up with was a really, really cool concept. I don't feel like they abandoned the snowball concept. They just didn't take it to its conclusion.
Right.
It was implied in the way it was happening. They just didn't explore that as much in the episode.
And I love that the Borg do this, that they, you know, they take over a ship and make it Borg. Like they did it to Voyager, they did it to the Enterprise E, and they did it to this ship. And it would have been cool to see like it become a sphere or something down the line. But the Borg themselves, it's not just the nanoprobes are an infection. The Borg are an infection, and they take over whatever. Even if it's a ship, it's a planet, and they turn it into looking like the Borg. It's got the little green tubules everywhere and little electricity bits.
Yeah. They make sure to put
really
in
cool.
all their like big old strobe lights and stuff to make sure
yes,
they can
exactly.
get down. But no, I agree, Greg. That's exactly the point I was just going to make. Like in First Contact, what do we see when we see the Enterprise assimilated? The guys, you know, the away team down below decks drops down a level, and all of a sudden a corridor is Borgified right in front of them. And it's like, oh, well, how did that even happen? Did they like build that? But then in this episode, you get to see like one of the Tarkalian, the assimilated Tarkalians shoots the tubules into the bulkhead behind a panel and instantly, I mean, you get a software upgrade, you know, to Borgified, but also like it's almost as if there's some kind of replicator function that is inherent in whatever is carried by the tubules in addition to the nanoprobes. Like, because this instant Borg hardware is just manufactured and grows out of the bulkhead in 4 or 5 seconds. I mean, that's kind of terrifying. Right. Just the speed by which that happened was pretty scary.
It's a lot like Wesley's nanites
from
the episode Evolution. And you just think of, you know, stick nanoprobes in a computer system like the Enterprise's, and it's gonna do just crazy stuff. And it can mess with biology, but it can also mess with mechanical things, which is crazy. And I love when they download the virus or the activation code, and the room just like turns green and activates.
Yes,
it's. And, wow.
And Debbie is down there going, hey, our captain wrote all this stuff just turned on down here. I don't know what's happening.
some were Borg something or another.
You mean some kind of unidentified cybernetic being.
Exactly.
Connor Trinneer is the best.
Well, at least one thing it tells me is that the Borg never assimilated the Microsoft Windows development team, because what did it take Microsoft
true.
7 years to go from XP to Vista? And yet the Borg, they can do the software upgrade and new hardware popping out even in a matter of, it's not even a second, right? It's almost instantaneous.
It's almost, yeah, exactly.
It's pretty amazing. It was, yeah. It was, what do they call that? A Delta update?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. Only the extra parts you need, right? Yes.
Right.
I'm sure there's a Delta Quadrant joke to be made there, but I think I'll move on. Ooh. Yeah. Ooh. No. I just blew your mind, didn't I?
I just fell over.
Well, this might be a good transition point to another thing to talk about here, that there is one kind of social commentary element in here that goes on with Phlox, and I believe it's Reed, actually, that has the conversation with him, which is kind of unusual. You don't see that very often on Enterprise. But talking about whether we should use technology to enhance ourselves, you know, whether it be for a medical condition or whether it be just improve ourselves. And they don't explore it very much. It's just in here just a little bit, but it's another example of Star Trek talking about a timely issue. You know, as right now, there are so many medical advances where we are using technology, of course, artificial joints and artificial hearts and all. And then, as we talked about on here quite a few months ago, even these 3D printers now where they can print synthetic organs in three dimensions that they can implant. So it seems that we are headed down that road a little bit. And it's actually something I hit on just a little bit in the Matter stream that's going to be out today as we're recording this, where I interviewed Seth Shostak, who's the senior astronomer at the SETI Institute. But at one point, anyway, we were talking about kind of the future of, you know, how things would be and whether or not we are headed towards that path of the Borg in terms of, you know, our biological life forms versus technology and computers. Well, we were talking about, you know, civilizations that are very advanced and, you know, who we might meet. But this was, for me anyway, a nice little element in here, because these are the types of things that I look for in Star Trek episodes.
Yeah, definitely. And it was touched on in last week's episode as well, Blood Fever, with talked about Tuvok's artificial arm, or artificial elbow, I guess.
Yeah.
Picard has his artificial heart. But there's nobody on Enterprise with artificial body parts, at least that we ever find out about. It appears it's sort of like the transporter, where it's something that people still aren't quite used to at this point in the timeline. And I don't know. I mean, there's an elbow I can see getting my elbow replaced. A heart? I don't know if I want an actual artificial heart. That's kind of scary to me. And then to have an entire limb replaced. And then the deep integration of circuitry that the Borg have is something that I know some people are excited about. You know, Ray Kurzweil talks about the singularity, where we're sort of become one with I don't want to say cybernetic, but just become one with the machines.
We want to bond with the machines, right?
Exactly. Ray Kurzweil wants his own bonding. But that doesn't thrill me. That scares me. Just like as you're saying, Reed, it scares Reed a bit. What about you, Mike? Do you have an artificial heart? Or do you want one?
Greg, I don't have any heart. No, it's entirely right. I'm like Reed too, and we were talking a second ago about like the Verge cast, and we're talking about, you know, technology and how that's kind of one thing that all three of us, I think, at least follow in a minor way. And I think almost everyone is in agreement, if you look far enough down the road, that we are going to see more and more kind of implantable technology, right? Mm-hmm. If we don't get to a point like the binars, that's fine, but we're going to have stuff that's probably going to be implantable, and that scares me. I think that is what will make me old. That is what will finally, turn me into someone who is the old man who doesn't want to do the new thing that all the kids are doing. It's like, you know, putting a wristwatch right under your skin you never have to take off. You know, it's like, no, I much prefer it outside of my body. You know, even as a gadget lover, it's just...
It seems like some kind of chip, you know, I mean, I've read about this and it seems perfectly plausible, you know, some kind of chip that could be implanted that would allow you to have access to the internet, you know, or to communications with each other without having to have a device or anything. That seems like a very realistic thing that could be in our future. And then the question is, if we start implanting these types of things, I mean, then do we become Borg-like? Do we have a collective consciousness at that point? Where,
right. You know, I mean, we're already getting to the point where I'm always connected with everyone just with Twitter. I mean, I can put it away. Can I put it away? I'm actually not sure if I can. Theoretically, I can put Twitter away and be broken from the hive mind. But once that is implanted, once I have my eye contacts, you know, that's a lowercase I because it's from Apple. Or once they start just replacing my eyes with eyes, will I be able to put Twitter down? You know, I won't be able to remove my eyes. And the whole internet, everyone I want to connect with will be there as a part of me. And it's an exciting thing, you know, to not have to carry around a phone and tap on it. It's just a part of me. But even, I was going to say, Geordi doesn't want to do that. You know, Geordi wears that headband for a long time before he even gets replacement eyes. And he was blind at birth. Everyone else on the ship still has their original eyes. So even in the Star Trek future, people aren't enhancing themselves.
Right.
They're only fixing themselves. But I see in the next 100 years, we're going to be enhancing ourselves. Maybe not everybody, maybe just the kids, maybe just some of the kids, maybe just the rich people. But I really see it happening. And it's going to be weird to see, and it's going to be really confusing. Like the guy with the Bluetooth in his ear, now he doesn't even have a Bluetooth in his ear. It's just implanted somewhere in his mouth.
Right. And this is so antithetical to everything that's cool about science fiction, at least for me. Like, I grew up watching Star Trek when I was young, and, you know, I talked about this in the Communicators article and all that stuff. It's like, God, I want all those devices. And now, I mean, it's not even 300 years later, it's 20 years later, and I have almost all those devices, right? And that's what I was excited about, and now I have it. To me, a future where, like, you have all that kind of stuff implanted in you for instant access is much more convenient, sure. But then you can't carry around cool stuff. Like, that's why I wanted to live here in the future, and I'm happy in this particular future. I don't want that. I don't want a contact lens with the internet in it. Give me a pad. Like, they're cooler because I grew up wanting that PC of the future, right?
We'll be reading your next technology feature, Michael. Living in the future, implants.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And
then I'll just go for a long
drive. We may get some unexpected visitors from Google to that article.
I mean, there's already people doing, you know,
I just got
crazy body modification. You know, those people are going to be doing all sorts of stuff at the very least. I don't know. It does scare me at some point. I see your point about wanting to carry a gadget. Does it stop being a gadget when it is implanted?
Totally.
I mean, my eyes are gadgets. Maybe.
Right. Yeah.
Or what's that guy from, is it First Contact who has the nose that's been replaced?
Oh, Nikki,
Nikki
the
nose. What's shaking dicks?
I wonder if that has some sort of enhanced smelling.
Let's get better at
processor.
Yeah.
It has an enhanced smelling processor, but also you have the ability to shut it off. So if it's really smelly,
so
you know, around
offensive,
you. Like
yes,
you're in an elevator, you know. And I thought you were going to talk about Inspector Implant a little bit as well.
Well, let me bring it close to home for you, Chris. Say one of your kids comes home. You know, they're 18 and they went to the local implant shop, and now, you know, they have their phone. You know, is implanted in their ear, and their eyes have been replaced with. And what I mean, what do you say? Are you shocked at that point? Do you see? Are you an old fogey if you look down on them and say, "Your gadget should be outside your body, darn it"?
So they have their ear has been replaced with a phone, and they have eyes.
Yep,
is what you're saying.
That's the situation that I'm. That's how hypothetical
I feel about that. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, it reminds me of the movie Gattaca a little bit too, where you have to. You know, the parents who can't afford to genetically enhance their children, those children are kind of left out of the society at that point, you know.
Because
I mean, my dad, when he was my age, was working on a computer that was the size, probably bigger than the apartment that I'm living in right now. And now my little phone is about, you know, at least 10 times more powerful than that computer. Yeah. And that was, you know, so I'm thinking 20 years from now, you know, my phone won't be that much smaller. It's just going to be a part of me. So I think people in 20 years are going to look back at us having this discussion and think this is silly.
So amazingly archaic, yeah.
Yeah, probably. So archaic. Why would you want to carry a pad? Why wouldn't you want to just bring it up, Minority Report, in front of your face and be waving your hands around?
Yeah.
It's going to be normal. It's going to be typical to just have implants and to be have it a part of yourself.
I hope it's something really that no one else can see but you. So like right now when you see people with the Bluetooth earpiece and they're like walking through the mall talking to themselves, but they're actually right on the phone, you'll just see somebody like waving their hands in front of them like this, and they're manipulating some data that you can't see.
Well, what I'm hoping for is a sort of combined future. There's the TV show Caprica showed this, where you have this sort of group consciousness internet where people enter it. But a better version of it is on a Japanese show that I'm forgetting the name of at the moment. But the kids have these glasses that they wear that put an overlay on the entire world. Like the girl has a dog that's a digital dog, and other people who wear the glasses can see the dog.
So it's like an augmented reality layer.
They put their hand up to their face.
Okay. Yeah.
And so the glasses let them enter this world, and anyone who doesn't have the glasses on can't see it, but anyone with the glasses is clued in. And so they have this shared sort of meta universe where there's fantastic things that can happen in real life, which I think is very cool. So when you see the guy waving his hands around, as long as you've got the glasses on, you can see that he's tapping on something. Denno Coil is the name of the show. Denno Coil.
Ah, okay. Right. Yeah. Well, that kind of thing is probably not too far from reality at this point.
No, I mean, we already have the augmented reality applications for iOS and for Android, which, you know, I mean, if you and I are both looking through our respective devices at the same landscape, we're seeing the same thing ultimately, and nobody else can tell that, you know, there's a subway hiding around the corner,
exactly,
making that mildly offensive smell. So it's like, yeah, so yeah, we already have that to an extent, and yeah, it's only going to grow. That's really depressing. It actually makes me really sad, the prospect of losing our gadgets. I'm going to be the only guy in 50 years carrying around external devices.
Why are you carrying that iPad, old man?
I do what I like. I look at the internet the way I want. Like Samuel Clemens.
Get your digital artifacts off my lawn.
Madam Guinan.
All right. Well, before we wrap up the discussion here about this, I think, Greg, you wanted to mention a few things here with the TNG references that are scattered throughout this story.
So that's where we were. This episode, I kept wanting to call it Star Trek: The Next Regeneration.
Yeah.
Because it's got so many next-gen references in it. It references the Bynars, as you said. Obviously, it references First Contact. They make the holographic bullets joke, which is fantastic. Even the Tarkalians are a next-gen reference, aren't they?
DS9,
they were a species. Okay. So all these things, and it's great to see them referencing all of that stuff for us as the fans. This is the way you ought to do it.
Yeah. Did they, they kind of, in their own way, I guess, had a mini staff meeting as well when they were looking through the pictures there, right?
Oh, they did,
Yeah, they had a little staff meeting, about their staff meeting.
Am I the only one who paused my Netflix to read Cochrane's Yale commencement speech?
I wanted to so bad, but I was like, no.
Well, was it cool? It's funny that you mentioned that, because on the commentary, Mike Sussman mentions that he got a call from the graphics department, and they said, what do you want it to say? And he said, what do you mean, why do I want it to say? He said, well, the screen, it's going to be visible on camera, so we can't just type anything in there. So he had to write, I think he said he wrote a biography of Archer and a biography of Hoshi, and I guess there was the commencement speeches in there too somewhere. But they actually write this stuff to put it up on the screen so that people like you, Greg, can pause it.
Well, scene where we see Archer just in his, I think he's in his quarters or whatever, reading the screen. Mm-hmm. And this is like an act before he mentions it to anyone else. But if you pause it real quick, you can read the entire speech and see that Cochrane was talking about these cybernetic men from the future. And then there's a later scene where he has T'Pol come and read it. But if you're quick-footed with that pause button, you could have been like totally ahead of everyone else.
Yeah,
and known that they were going for that Cochrane.
I like when they do things like this because again, there's a screen like this in Inner Mirror Darkly, which is how we know that Archer was the first president of the Federation as well.
Oh,
yeah, it's in his service record that's being looked up on the computer.
And that's how we learned a lot of stuff about the about the Next Generation crew in Conundrum. With the crew manifest that they're looking up to see who they were. Like, we learned birth dates and graduation dates and specialties, all this kind of stuff. Like, I feel like that's what Star Trek The Encyclopedia references for all of the main cast of Next Generation.
Right. That's why Rose started really going after Riker in that episode, right? Because she read his service record and she found out that he was a ladies' man, right?
Order of Merit with clusters. Hey.
Yeah.
I think that screen on In a Mirror Darkly is the one that did reveal that Hoshi was actually the hottest empress ever.
Oh, man. Yeah. She won
the award. Yeah. Yeah, I remember that reference there. I think I actually traveled to the future and voted for her, in fact.
Did you? Vote every day.
In that same vein of like TNG shout-outs, how did you feel about the ending, guys? Did it evoke any memories of a Next Gen episode to you? Or am I alone in this?
Which episode did it evoke?
They're in the quarters of talking about the pulsar map. You know what I'm talking about? It was very, to me, it was very conspiracy. It was very season one conspiracy.
Oh, okay.
Homing beacon to Earth.
Right.
You know? And also, it was also the end of Q Who, right? They'll be coming.
And that's,
They're coming.
I mean, that's the direct one. But yeah, conspiracy too. It's a weird ending because they win, but they also lose.
Right.
But they don't lose in any way that is going to affect any of them. I mean, Archer is going to go on to become president and die an old man.
Right.
But nevertheless, the Borg are still coming.
Yeah, they lose for their great-grandchildren.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, talk about Borg under the table. I mean, that's for like a couple centuries of suspense.
Right. All right. Well, why don't we wrap up here with just final overall thoughts on the episode?
It's always nice to see that the even in a great episode like this, we still have plating percentage drops and things.
23%.
Oh dear God. Yeah. And the Borg, man, if you can't shoot them with your phase pistol, if they keep adapting, man, just rip out the wires, man.
Let me just interject one thing here. I found it interesting that when Archer and Reed, right, are putting the charges on in the Borg ship, that the three Borg drones that were in the room with them, though, they didn't adapt. Now they just shot one of them. He's gone.
I know.
The next one comes. It doesn't adapt either. I thought for sure, the third one's going to adapt. Nope. He's out of it too. They were just asleep at the alcove.
Right. I think those scenes must have been supposed to be intercut because the scene before, the Borg had already learned to adapt. And then all of a sudden, they weren't adapting anymore.
Were they adapting on the survey ship? Were they adapting on the Borg ship? Or were they only adapting on Enterprise? I can't remember which was the case.
So there was a scene, they had upgraded the weapons.
Right.
And then
the phasers
there was
all
a scene
hot.
Where they were shooting them and they killed a few of them. Right. And then they started adapting.
And then they
went over to the survey ship and suddenly none of them were adapting. But don't they already have the hive mind? Shouldn't they all be adapting at that point?
I don't know if that's how it works. It's always seemed like, it's a really good question about the Borg in general. Does the hive mind adapt so this frequency, all Borg everywhere are now adapted to it? Or is it like within a vicinity because do they forget too? Because like they rotate the phaser frequencies, right?
Yeah.
With these three specific drones, I'm just thinking that I don't have a problem with the first one not adapting. But if there are three of them in the room together, you would think that by the third one, because they're not changing the phaser at that point, they're just shooting.
Right. And they shot a lot of them before they started adapting.
Yeah.
They did. Yeah. Even I was impressed by the body count before they started adapting. But, you know, these Borg do seem to be actually a little bit not to say handicapped, but they seem to be a little bit attenuated by their sheer lack of scale, because there's only about 20 of them. Right? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the nanoprobes don't work as quickly.
They've been frozen for 200 years.
Right. So maybe they've got a lot of
groggy.
Yeah. Remember, frostbite damage, because they're
thawing out still.
Yeah.
Remember too that this is not the collective. Like when you hear the way of the board, but you'll be assimilated, it's just a few voices. Right. Like from was it Unity, where there's just the few of them?
Yeah.
On Voyager. Yeah. So it's not, they don't have the power of the collective behind them. They're a small collective. I think that helps them.
Yeah.
That does make it so they don't adapt as quick. They're not as good at being Borg.
And that makes perfect sense.
So far from home.
Too. Yeah, that makes sense.
Does.
Right. Anything else, Michael? I interrupted your train of thought there to talk about
Borg. If I can interject before Mike interjects. You were saying about the tubules. Like, this is what Data figured out in First Contact. Well, it's the ripping of the head tubes is like the fastest way to kill a Borg. Because they have no defense against it.
No
defense whatsoever.
It's the weirdest thing ever. It's like, you can fire a particle. What is it, like 10 megajoules, he said?
Exactly.
It's
just
like, man, that doesn't bother me, but you rip out my head wire, I'm down. I'm dead.
I'm down for the count.
So basically, if you're ever being chased by Borg down on a planet, look for like a briar patch or something. Mm-hmm. Something with low-hanging vines.
They'll catch.
Yep.
Take off running. The Borg, they'll catch that tube on a branch, rip it right out.
Then they'll just be on the floor gyrating to the strobe lights. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that this is something that they teach to all red shirts.
Yeah. Or at least they should, right? Before I just have one more question. I'm not going to drag this out like I did on the bonding, but why do the Borg aboard the Enterprise, right at the end of the episode, why do they beam back to the survey ship as it's become the most vulnerable thing in the world? Like, the survey ship is disabled. Do they beam back to go try and repair it or what? Because they leave Enterprise right quick.
Oh, when they beam off. Yeah, I was wondering about that too.
The reason is because it's not a two-parter.
That is entirely true. You're right.
If it had been a two-parter, they would have stayed on the Enterprise. They would have continued to, and it would have been like First Contact, basically. But they would have just tried to Borgify the Enterprise at that point.
Yeah, agreed.
I think they do go back to try to stop the explosives and destroy Archer before they can affect the blowing up the ship. But you know, it doesn't make an awful lot of sense, because you're there, you have already adapted to the phased weapons, you have free reign basically at this point.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, and we've seen in the past that when their ship is going to be destroyed, they beam over to another ship. Right.
These ones specifically, like these are the ones that went to the Enterprise.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe these are the guys that failed at the Borg Academy, like the Borg School dropouts. They're really confused.
Like
they think when the ship is going to blow up, beam back. No. Beam
this
off.
This is true. This is what happened in First Contact. Most of the Borg beamed to the Enterprise right before it was blown up. These are the Borg that beamed back.
Yeah,
right. That's right.
The Enterprise got blown up.
Well, now it all makes perfect sense. These are the guys that beamed back in the first place, right?
The guys that repeated Borg Academy,
right. It's like, you know, if you don't learn from history, you're doomed to repeat it. And here are these guys. They're like, what did we do last time this happened? Beam back to the exploding ship.
It worked last time.
I just adored this episode. Maybe it's because I went into it with the lowest of expectations. I don't know, but I really, this is in a really great league of episodes, and I'm really, really glad that it was made.
Yeah, yeah. Manny Coto says this is one of his favorite episodes of the show. Obviously, before he came on the show, this is when they were really hitting it out of the park. When I looked it up on Netflix, I went to season 4 because I was like, this is a mid-season Manny Coto episode, must be. And I was like, wait, this is season 2, really? And this is, again, where I'm so disappointed they went down the whole Zindi route, because they had it. They were there. They had officially grown the beard at this point in the show. And I don't know why they didn't just continue down this exact path, because it's perfect. This is the show I wanted Enterprise to always be.
Yeah. When I watched this one, rewatched it here over the past couple of days, one of the first things I was struck with was how much I like Enterprise, because I don't watch Enterprise as often as I watch the other series, but I really like the series. And This was a case. Now, I actually think there are quite a few good episodes in season two. I know season two, one and two kind of get a bad rap sometimes, but this was a case where, this was very well crafted. They did something very dangerous in taking the Borg and putting them into a prequel series, but they did it in a way that tied the whole Star Trek history together and created that kind of temporal loop that both confuses you on the one hand, but makes you appreciate the depth of Star Trek at the same time. And, I thought for the most part, it's well written. Towards the end, some of the stuff on the corridors, with the Borg coming down the corridors of the ship and all, it was kind of formulaic. It's like Next Generation, Voyager, First Contact, the movie, all over again, like the same thing in there. But I know they have to throw that in for the action, but the bigger story here and how it ties in is great. And they were able, as we talked about extensively here, slip in that social message about, technological enhancement to us as a species, and they even managed to get that in as well. So it wasn't just the pure Borg action for ratings kind of thing that we often saw in Voyager. So, I think definitely one of the better episodes of Enterprise, which is surprising considering that it's so hated by so many fans. One of the, it's probably not in my top, 10 or 20 all-time Star Trek episodes, but it's definitely, considering that there are, 750, 60 or so episodes.
It's a tall order.
It's up in that very upper portion of episodes for me, top 5% or so probably anyway.
Agreed.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Well, Michael, thanks for joining us again today as we talk about Enterprise. I think it's your first time with us for Enterprise, isn't it?
It most certainly is, yes. And I was, I'm very pleased it happened on this episode. I think we had a good discussion here, guys. Thank you. Thank you again for having me.
And Michael, while you're on here, I think I mentioned this in news actually, but I just want to recommend everyone go over to our Audio Captain's Log and listen to your communicators narration that you just did, that we just posted, because it's really fantastic.
Good. I'm glad. I have to re-listen to it myself. I don't remember anything about what my tone was or anything of that sort. So I would love to go listen to that again, and then I will probably record pads in the near future as well.
Yeah. Well, if anyone has read the article, they'll know it's very lighthearted, very fun look at technology and communicators. And your narration brought that to life even more. So I'm really glad that you took the time to record that for us.
Thank you for asking me to do it. I had a ball. So thank you.
Well, it's always great to talk about Enterprise, Chris, and it's great to have Michael Fisher back with us now that union rules allow us to have him back on without having to pay him actual living wages. I'm sure we'll have him back in a few weeks again once the time period has passed.
That's right. Yeah, we were going to have to get the food cart ready, I think, if we had him on three shows in a row.
Yeah, we'd have to actually start paying attention to that demands letter he wrote with the green M&Ms and the red vines with salt are already put inside. I threw the thing in the shredder, but apparently if we had him on three shows in a row. Anyway, the one last thing I was going to mention about Enterprise was the makeup in this show was astonishing. Seeing Phlox. So you have Phlox already has makeup, and then he goes through three or four stages of being Borgified. And it just, every time it looks even cooler. Same thing with the Tarkalians, where they have makeup and then they have Borg makeup on top, and then they have the full Borg makeup. Was that something that stood out for you, Chris, too?
Yeah, but I think you watched it in HD, I think, right? And I just have the regular DVDs, and I usually end up having to watch these things on my computer. So the window's fairly small, so I didn't notice it quite as much. But I can't imagine in HD.
And maybe that SD-HD difference is what explains. Near the end of the show, I was looking up on my iPad for who won the Emmy for Best Prosthetic Makeup on a TV series. And Enterprise, of course, was nominated. I think it was nominated every year it was on the air. It actually lost in 2003 to Primetime Glick, which you may not be familiar with, but that is Martin Short in a fat suit.
Oh, I remember that.
Let that sink in. Martin Short in a fat suit beat Regeneration for an Emmy, which that is a travesty. I'm going to go get a hotel room and I'm going to trash the hotel room. I'm going to throw a television out the window over this right just, after the show.
Right now, in 2012, you're protesting the Emmy results from 9 years ago,
yes.
Right?
Yes, I am. It's an outrage. Michael Westmore was robbed. Robbed, I say.
You know, while you're talking about the makeup here, one thing I forgot to mention during the feature is there was one huge missed opportunity in this episode, and that was that,
oh, was that?
Porthos was not assimilated.
Oh, Borg Porthos. Wasn't there a non-canon novel about him?
I think so, yeah. The Adventures of Borg Porthos.
If they'd had a B-story, if they'd had a B-story in Regeneration, it would have been about Borg Porthos.
I'm just picturing, you know, they said they had 3 or 4 different stages of assimilation makeup, mm-hmm. you know, guidelines about the makeup. What would it have been like for dogs? What would the different stages of canine assimilation look like? That's what I want to know. And I'm really disappointed that we didn't get to see that.
Have you seen the concept art of his prosthetic tail? Did you see that?
No, it's on Memory Alpha. Is it detachable? Where
it is.
Like the Borg arms, can he put like different types of tools on his tail?
Yeah, there's different things. You know, if he needs like a little grabber tool, he's got one of those. He's got a little drill, a little rocket launcher.
I like the drill when he's like rubbing up against the wall. People are like, what's wrong with him? He's got butt itch or something? No, I think he's just drilling a hole in the wall.
Oh, man. All right.
See, this is why. I mean, that's like worth a whole star in rating this episode for me. They missed this opportunity.
If you've made it this far, it's just gone from 4 stars to 5 stars.
Yeah, that's in there. Okay, Craig, why don't we move on and tell people where to find us if they want to share their thoughts with us about Regeneration. Just go to trek.fm/contact. You can send us a text message. You can call 646-652-TREK if you want to leave us a voicemail. And you can go to Twitter and follow username TrekFM, where you'll find us talking about Star Trek round the clock. And Greg, I think everyone can find you on Twitter also.
Yep, I am on Twitter as Greg Harbin. And I've actually been tweeting from TrekFM a bit recently. I've been making some extremely obscure jokes. I don't know, Chris, if you go back and read some of the things I tweet as a TrekFM. When they get no responses, I think I figure I probably went a little too far.
A little too far. I read the ones that you tweet where someone else has replied back to you.
Right. Okay.
The ones that you tweeted that got no response that happened when in the middle of the night for me, when I'm asleep, I don't necessarily see them all. So never know what's going to come back to me one day.
I discovered that Cliff Bull was a director for TNG back in the day, and famously, Will Wheaton complained about his direction because Cliff Bull kept giving him this terrible direction and was trying to make him in awe of Picard by telling him, Picard controls the sky, man. He controls the sky.
Now it all makes sense.
My tweet was that Cliff Bull directing films for the Army explains why your Army buddies came home believing that President Obama controls the sky.
Okay. It all makes sense now.
If anyone was reading our Twitter and they didn't understand that tweet, I hope that this long explanation has brought you up to speed. Otherwise, let's just move on.
Let's just move on. All right. Okay. But so, Greg, you are at Greg Harbin on Twitter.
Yes, I am.
And probably tweeting about Battlestar Galactica, I'm sure. And
most likely
providing the rules for a new game that we're working on for the Ready Room. It's a Ready Room drinking game where you do a shot of tequila every time Greg mentions BSG.
Yes. I tried to limit my BSG in this episode. I don't know how well I managed. It's difficult. It really is.
All right. Well, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. And you can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM and on Google Plus at our short link hyperchannel/TrekFMG+, where we post some of the things that are just a little bit too long for Twitter. And we should also mention, if you want to find Michael on Twitter, you can do that as well. His username is Fats Riker Beard. And I promise you, one of these days, we are going to find out why. couple more things to mention, Greg. We should remind everyone that you can find the show on Stitcher. If you don't use iTunes, if you're streaming this from the website and you do use Stitcher, look us up there. Might be a little bit easier than streaming. And also tune in. Should be out by the time this comes out. This week's episode of Matter Stream, where I interview Seth Shostak. I think you'll find that very interesting to talk about SETI and first contact situations. All right, Greg, I'm going to head off. David Livingston rushed this episode so much that they've called me in to write an extra scene for the Blu-ray release. So I got to go do that.
All right, Chris. I think it's time to airlock some Borg from it, because the Ready Room is done.